Eric Forer has been a fisherman and a plumber, an activist in his youth, a carpenter, and a fine woodworker. As a regent for the University of Alaska, he is an outspoken proponent and advocate for higher education at a time when the state and its future may face severe economic struggles. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. I hope you'll join me as we talk with University Regent Eric Forer. Eric, your educational background is not the norm. You were raised largely in Bush, Alaska, by parents who taught for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and taught since third grade on by correspondence. Can you give me a sense, so we can get a picture of it, of the scope and depth of that education? How do you look at it when you look back?
Well, much of it did not, in fact, occur in Alaska. Much of it occurred in a little school in Arizona, which was 30 miles from the Mexican border, in a almost a third world enclave within the borders of the United States, the Papago Indian Reservation. And I was there for 6 years in grade school by correspondence and came to Alaska and spent 3 years in the bush in Alaska. And the good side of it, the upside, is that I think that a young person who goes through an experience like that gets considerable depth in the subjects, because there's simply no distractions. You're on all the time for 8 hours a day, or however long you're in school. And in my case, I got a dinner break. My father granted me a dinner break, and I went back into it in the evenings. And what leisure time there is tends to be quite interesting and exciting, because you're either in the country or on the river or whatever. The downside is that there's no socializing process. And what that turns out to be in the end is a culture clash, a culture crisis. When you do get pushed out into the real world and go to university or something, there's all kinds of skills that you discover you do not have. And then there's a reckoning you pay with time to learn those skills, to catch up to where you need to be just to survive the system, which is a sort of a separate issue from the subject you're pursuing.
But which is related in as much as a young child would be socialized as that child learned in a regular school setting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I learned all kinds of things that I think probably are immensely valuable to know, but in some sense are archaic. It's archaic knowledge for me to know some of the things I know. I never use the knowledge except maybe in terms of thinking skills.
I want to ask this a different way. Both our president and our governor have supported what they call educational choice in lower school, elementary school and grammar school. What they're indicating is that we would probably go to a voucher system that would support a diversification in education, correspondence, private schools, as well as public education, rather than a focus on public schools. From your experience, does this give you an opinion on any side of that question?
Well, unfortunately, it probably puts me on the fence a little bit, although I tend to think that the voucher idea is a bad idea, which is sort of a predictable response to an even worse situation. That it might work in some senses better than what has been going on in the recent past, but it probably isn't the real answer. I do favor diversity sort of as a general principle, so maybe in the sense that it will create diversity, it may be a good idea.
But in answering what you consider the worst of public schools' problems?
Really tough to say. I don't know. I'm not prepared to fight it. I'm prepared to watch it happen. If asked, if put in the position to decide, I would probably decide against the idea. But I would give whoever needs to make the decision a short period of time to find an alternative, because relying on where we sit now is not the answer.
We're talking today in Conversations with Eric Forer, regent for the University of Alaska, As Eric indicated, he was educated from the third grade on by correspondence by his folks. When he graduated, he was awarded the Outstanding High School Supervised Correspondence Student of the Year in the United States. That was in 1959-60. His dad was given the Alaska Governor's Award for Excellence in Teaching in 1970. And during the time when he taught, Eric's father taught at EEC Alaska, I understand some of the artwork from his students were displayed at the White House. We're talking today about education with Regent Eric Forer. This is Conversations. We will spend the bulk of our time talking about higher education. I want to turn to it now. The Board of Regents in the state of Alaska has a great authority, one of six states in the nation that has such authority over a university. And it does so by constitution. Can you give us a sense of the powers, the authority of that board?
Well, I'm not sure that I can. That's one of the things that nobody quite tells you that when you go into sitting on a board. It's one of the things you get a feel for and you learn as you go along.
From your perspective, the authority?
Well, I think that I came hard up against that question a few months ago in thinking about the budget. And went back to the fact that the board takes its authority from the Constitution. And came to the conclusion that the first thing that the board needs to do is hire effective administrative leadership. Having done that, having succeeded in doing that, which is in itself a minefield, the next most important function of the board is to fight for the university. Not for particular programs, not for particular issues, but for the university as a whole. Because there's an adversarial kind of relationship between the board and the state administration, the board's role is to fight for the university. If that is a successful, or as it would inevitably be, usually partially successful effort, then you may have the luxury of dealing with programs, directions, but those are in fact luxuries. My predecessor, who held the seat on the board that I sit in, Don Abel from Juneau, never once in his many years on the board, a term and a half at least, had the luxury of doing what he thought he would be able to do when he was on the board. He was fighting fires and struggling with the first two issues the whole time. So in some senses, this particular board has the luxury to think about programs and directions, and it is because of good work done in the immediate past. Recent past? Immediate past?
The governor has been critical of the university. He said fairly recently that he thought its successes were modest and spotty, given the money that's put into it. I absolutely do not want a public relations answer from you to this question, but you have to, in your time of sitting on the Board of Regents, done some assessing of this university. Where do you think it stands in terms of its performance?
I think it stands pretty well. As a matter of fact, near the top of American universities. This question has been asked in public and private quite a bit. And recently in a board meeting, I made the point that in every house in America is a furnace that is 25% efficient, and nobody complains, nobody says a word about it. It's just the state of the art. 25% efficiency is what we get, and that's what we accept. Something like the university is not 100% efficient, and it will never achieve 100% efficiency. And if you view the university as a business or as a machine and you complain about its inefficiency, you've missed the point. I think the university is cheap for what it does, and I can cite any number of personal experiences with friends who have had their lives entirely saved and changed for the better by the university. It is an inefficient thing to watch from the outside, and you can easily come to the conclusion that this is crazy, we should be doing this different. But I think that basically we're getting good value.
When a university, this one, say this system, is doing its best, inefficient or efficient, what's it doing? What's it giving? What's its chief role, I think, is what I'm asking you. Is it to transform lives?
Well, its chief role is to transmit knowledge. Lying on the floor here beside me is a manuscript, and I'm tempted to read a paragraph out of it, but maybe I won't. Knowledge is just the tool that the human race has to make progress with. Other things go by the wayside, technologies change, but knowledge and the accumulation of knowledge about everything is the tool which will enable us to deal with the present and the future, and that's what the university is about. It is about knowledge and about the future. And all the inefficiencies and what have you are just part of the process.
Does it then not matter how many MBAs and English teachers, engineers that we turn out in the process?
Probably doesn't matter. That kind of thing, the certificate kind of thing, is more related, in my view, to money and jobs and the way things work in the economic world. But in terms of getting a populace that can think on its feet, 3 years of college is a valuable experience, even if you end up with no certificate. 2 years of college is a valuable experience. The community colleges, the community college mission, providing 2 years of experience, is immensely valuable. So no, I don't think it matters how many degrees we turn out. That's the bean counting side of it, and I place not too much value on that.
We have been told for three administrations now that we are going into severe economic times. Prudhoe is declining, the 80% of our income that we bring in from that big piece of pipe is going to slip away from us in the next decade. This has to be a consideration for education, as it is a consideration for roads, care for the elderly, social services, primary and secondary education. How do you think, given your philosophy of how what a university should be doing, we should approach that future as a university?
Well, the main problem between the state economy and the university mission is that the state population is not connected to income. I think that we're facing decisions about personal income tax and allocations of the permanent fund in the immediate or intermediate future to help solve some of these problems. The permanent fund was put in place in order to make to give us some resources for a rainy day, unquote. Well, the rain is beginning to fall. The state faces a demographic bulge, which is currently in place. To take Point Barrow as an example, and I'm not absolutely certain of these precise numbers, but the magnitudes are correct. The current high school class in Point Barrow is something like, let's say freshman high school class is something like 80. The first grade in Barrow is 380. This bulge in rural population and urban population is upon us. It's here now. It's not going to be here. It's not a prediction. It's here. And so when those 380 kids all line up here on the campus to enter their freshman year of university,
10-12 years from now.
Yes. If the answer to them is, sorry, there's no room, there's no resources, there's no more oil money, that's not an acceptable answer. The entire state can't go outside for an education. The economy will continue to be connected to knowledge and degrees and education. So the answer is not to downsize the university necessarily. The answer is to come up with some new ways of keeping this rascal afloat.
In what is a nationwide ongoing recession at the same time?
That's correct.
Is that a chief obligation to keep the rascal afloat?
Yes, I believe so. I think a state without a university system is a state going backwards and going in a direction not the same as the human endeavor.
This is Eric Forer. He is a university regent and has been so since 1989, appointed by Governor Steve Cooper to this position. It is an 8-year term, No one can take a regent once appointed out of office. He or she stays until that time is done and then can be reappointed, as in Don Abel's case.
That's correct.
Right? Yeah. Governor Hickel has made some proposals. If we set aside the question of whether it is important to have an efficient university or not, and look at some of the directions he thinks are logical for a university in this state at this time, I'd like you to give kind of a critique of them. One of the proposals, and we don't know whether these are definite or just ideas at this point, but is to make specialty campuses out of Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. Liberal arts, essentially, he thinks would go to Anchorage. Fairbanks would deal with space and land grant, also with engineering and the whole northern studies perspective. And Juneau, being by the sea, would look at marine sciences, fish, sea grant. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of specializing the university out so that if you wanted to do space, you'd come here? If you wanted to do fish, you'd go to Juneau?
Well, it starts out as a pretty good idea. It falls into thinking about efficiencies and making the machine work better. But people don't fall into that same kind of easy classification. On the other hand, we must specialize to some extent. We cannot be everything to everybody. And in fact, universities nationwide, I think, are trying to be too much. They're trying to be everything for everybody, and it's impossible. Above the undergraduate level, I can see rapid specialization working well. Below the undergraduate level, specialization is not going to be a successful way to think about it. You simply can't take undergraduates and say, well, all you guys go to Fairbanks to study engineering, because in the case of Juneau, 25% of the graduating class of the Juneau High School lined up and enrolled at UAS. Those kids are living with their families. UAS, University of Alaska Southeast.
Juneau
in this case. Those kids are still living at home. There is no possible way for them to live not at home, because housing costs are very high and housing is not even available here, for instance. So specialization would have to occur pretty much above the undergraduate level.
I wonder also, given the encouragement by academics for universities to go heavily into cross-disciplinary studies. Biologists would also study ethics along with philosophy and the other complement of courses so that the biologist is enlightened in a complicated world. I wonder if that kind of specialization at the undergraduate level would lose the potential of cross-disciplinary understanding.
Well, it might. My personal philosophy is strongly to favor studying everything. I'm always mumbling on about the Renaissance man concept. Because everything is connected, the more you know about anything, the more you are able to know about the next thing. So in that sense, I'm opposed to specialization, but still we're faced with the financial reality and the reality of facilities and the reality of large populations of students. So specialization is in our future.
The governor has also asked that professors on campuses, faculty on campuses, focus on the North. What do you think of that notion?
I think it's sort of self-evident. This is a university in the North and should make use of the opportunities of its position, opportunities which I must say don't exist for most other institutions in the world. It's just a logical thing to do, and we are, in fact, doing it. The entire West Ridge, geophysical, SAR, the SAR facility and what have you, the rocket range, they all have a strong northern component. But if you shoot a rocket south, you get south fast, so you can't pretend they don't exist.
This is Conversations. We're talking today with Regent Eric Forer. I'm Susan McGinnis. There is another economic question, and that is the consolidation of both services and facilities. The governor would like to see facilities used year-round and facilities maximized so we don't have so many campuses around the state, so many buildings in use, and we use everything we can in the fewer that we would create in this transformation. Given how big our state is, how small our population is, and how diverse both the cultural and economic settings are, can we pull in that way from your perspective?
I think that if we are forced to do so, it will be bad news. We have to recognize what we are. We are a huge state. We cannot make ourselves smaller by moving everybody to a single point or by saying, well, all you guys are too far away from this magical spot here. X marks the spot, and if you're too far away from the spot, then you don't get a university campus. That kind of reasoning really doesn't hold water. We're a rural state. Maybe I shouldn't use rural so glibly. It's a tough proposition to define rural. We're a bush state, more so than any other state. And to start chipping away at that fact is to start turning Alaska into something else. So I think that the state has the responsibility to what amounts to the community college mission, if you work your way through the layers and you finally get back to that. Clearly we can't have major campuses scattered all over the place, but I think we need to maintain a community college mission level of presence wherever we possibly can.
And a community college level of presence means what to you? Geographic location or something more?
Well, it means, yes, geographic location and a two-year level of academic effort. Beyond 2 years, a student who wants to pursue an education can reasonably be expected to make the move and the sacrifice and needs to get out of the bush in order to learn some things. One of the big troubles with studying in the bush is it's isolation. You just can't import enough information and enough experiences to get the depth that you need.
Can you take a look at your youth growing up? And I would think that some of your experience in the lower 48 on reservations would also play here. What was that experience growing up like for you in terms of someone who was going to come out into larger society? Where was it? Where are its strengths and where are its weaknesses?
Well, I'm not sure I understand where its strengths are entirely. I do know something about its weaknesses because that's what you tend to have troubles with and work on. And its weakness is precisely lack of scope, lack of depth. I have some skills which I will probably never use again, and that takes the form of a fantasy of mine. I'm a carpenter, and I'm working away on a big building covered with tools and breathing sawdust, and my fantasy is that the Coast Guard comes and rescues me from this civilized setting and abandons me on an empty beach where I am then saved, which is precisely the opposite of the usual vision of the Coast Guard saving somebody from empty beach and bringing them back to civilization. I could throw down my tools on the empty beach and be quite comfortable. I'd scout myself up some food and shelter and what have you without any particular problem. And those skills I will probably never use again. I sit here without a degree because of cultural clash, having been unable to sort out all the stuff I needed to know when I got to the university. And this is an individual who had English as a mother language and really shouldn't have been that put off by the whole thing. So I am able to understand emotionally in considerable depth the problem faced by rural and native students coming to a university from the bush. So that is the problem with education in the bush. It does not provide enough depth.
Can you look a little more closely at difficulties Native Alaskans face as they come out of small communities, say, into University of Alaska Fairbanks, into University of Alaska at Anchorage or at Juneau. You've mentioned not enough depth. You mentioned earlier when we were talking in the hour that the community was so small, where you were especially in correspondence because it was a family size, that you had a culture shock when you went out to UAF. You went out to British Columbia. What are the particular problems of Native Alaskans?
Well, I'm not sure I'm prepared to tackle that one. It's really quite a huge subject. The problems of Native Alaskans you may have to bail me up by asking me another question. I mean, that's that's such a voluminous thing. I sit on the governor's subsistence council and have done for about a year. And the conversations there are about a subsistence lifestyle versus whatever it is we are beginning to have now. And in a year of conversations, we have not answered any serious questions like, what are the problems that Native Alaskans face when they come to the city? I have written some things about this, and I'll try to paraphrase it. I think that the main problem that Native Alaskans face, or at least a native youth faces now, is loss of a sense of place. If you're an Eskimo on the lower Yukon and you cannot hunt geese in the spring, and you cannot do those things which established your identity in the past, even if the reasons for not being able to do them are legitimate, game management issues or what have you, then you have lost the form of what identifies you. And that is what I call a sense of place. It is what I have, which was established by the lower Yukon, and I struggle with a loss of place. I can't go back to the lower Yukon. I can't make use of the skills I learned there. And I struggle every day with unsure footing because my sense of things doesn't match up with what is around me. So a native kid, a student or what have you, has lost a sense of place. Regaining that sense as an adolescent or a young adult is immensely difficult. It involves changing values. It involves saying, well, I'm not going to have dry fish for lunch. I'm going to have a hamburger. I tease the governor of the subsistence council. I say, Governor, you should provide us with dry fish for lunch here. And everybody laughs, and we go off and have hamburgers. But it's a serious teasing because that's the issue. Changing your entire framework from language right on through. And it's a very, very difficult proposition.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and we're talking with Eric Forer. Can this happen in this society at this time, where the sense of place is transferable?
Well, I don't think that it can happen easily, and it may take some generations for it to happen. It is probably inevitable due to the power of our technology and the power of Western culture. It's an overwhelming, sweeping kind of thing. No individual can stop this roll. There are no guilty parties anywhere. You can't point fingers at somebody and say, you guys did it. You know, it's just history rolling along, and history rolls over things, and in some cases it rolls over indigenous cultures. It's done so on every single continent. it's done so in every age. Attila the Hun rolled over a bunch of people, and I'm sure that they were not happy. In that case, at least from this distance in history, you can point your finger and say he was the bad guy, but in our current situation, we can't point any fingers because there's nobody to point fingers at. It's one of the sadder, more destructive elements in history, and it's almost evolutionary. We're sitting here watching evolution, and there's not a lot to be done about it except to attempt to understand it and use some imagination to solve the problems. And my complaint is that not enough imagination is used. One of the problems with this university system is that it tends to entrench ways of thinking, and it's very difficult to break away from those ways without a political battle. So instead of thinking about the issues, you end up fighting politics, and the issue gets lost with further losses of individuals. So it's almost like a low-level sort of warfare.
When you look back on your university experience, can you see ways where this university or the University of British Columbia could have made a place for Eric Forer coming out of Bush, Alaska?
Oh, yes. Yes, I certainly see ways. I saw all sorts of ways that they could have done things, which were not done. And I fell by the wayside because I was unable to hold myself up with my bootstraps. And really, if there was a place to turn to, I didn't know that it existed. I can't say it wasn't there, but I never did find it, which probably means that it either wasn't there or was so small and underfunded that it didn't make itself known. Yeah, there's a lot of things that can be done to make a rural or a native student succeed. And one of the problems is that those few individuals who know what those things are hard to find, difficult to track down. Those ideas are hard to come by because there's not too many people who have one foot in each camp. And you need a person with one foot in each camp in order to know how to transfer back and forth. Otherwise, nobody knows what to do. Mm-hmm. They stand around with good hearts, meaning well, but with no tools to work with.
This is a question that's probably way up in the clouds, but is it more a matter of spirit than of programs? More a matter of context?
That is not up in the clouds. It is exactly what it is. It's very much a matter of spirit. That's why it's so difficult. The concept of a sense of place and of values and of a spiritual base from which you can launch yourself out every morning to go deal with the day is so difficult that it's never been tackled. The problem is there, and people try to solve the problem with a program. You don't need a program. You need a sense of the problem and a spiritual base. I could talk about E. Card and my father's program a lot, which we won't have the time to do.
Give us a picture. What?
Well,
why did it come
I've
to
thought
mind?
About that over a lot of years. I've thought about it very hard. I've tried to write about it, and I've talked to people about it. And I have come to the conclusion that the reason he succeeded as a teacher of art was that he abandoned all formal thinking about education. He threw out all the rules, and he brought to that classroom nothing except a non-ideological honesty. He simply stopped trying so hard and started to deal with the kids as individuals who were coming from some place that he did not understand. They did not understand him, and he realized that he did not understand them, and he created an atmosphere in the classroom which was so open and so honest and so lacking in patronization or predetermined values that they were able to create their own values, and they were able to get in contact with each other to such a degree that they produced a body of graphic art that, to my knowledge, is unequaled in the world. And this the message of this success has fallen on deaf ears ever since, because in order to get there, you have to throw out everything you already know or think you know about education. And nobody's willing to abandon their dogma. They spent 15 years learning it. Why would they abandon it? Well, they need to abandon it. They have to abandon it to learn about education.
We are talking today with Eric Forer. I'm Susan McInnes, and this is Conversations. Eric Forer is a fisherman for halibut, captain of his own boat. He is the owner of the River Millworks in Juneau, a construction and also a fine woodworking firm. My understanding is that he makes beautiful inlaid tables and the like. As he mentioned, he is on the Governor's Commission on Subsistence, has been for the year of Governor Hickel's current tenure, and was appointed by Governor Cooper in 1989 to the Board of Regents for the University of Alaska. That is our chief topic today. Does it then take those who walk on the edge of education, those who are willing to push the envelope to transform education? Or do you think there will simply be periodic voices like your dad's saying, excuse me, this works, an entirely new concept, this works? The question, I guess, is do we learn, can we learn from your father's experience?
The question is, can the educators learn anything about what they do? And I reluctantly come to the conclusion over the years that I'm afraid the answer is no, they can't. It is a continuous mystery to me why education, which is supposed to be about learning, is so freighted down with dogma, more so than other disciplines, and can itself not learn, except very, very slowly and painfully over many years. And I think that's an evidence of how little they know. They know so little they're afraid to move, lest somebody discover how little they know. And that they know little is clearly in evidence just looking at national numbers. The numbers are horrifying, terrifying. The dropout rate is up in the stratosphere, and national achievement levels fall year after year. And this is not evidence of a dogma, of a body of knowledge which is correct or successful. There are lots of other factors like funding and what have you, but my father and others, there have been many others, were successful without increased funding and without increased magical dogmas. They simply brought a willingness to learn to the classroom. Now, I am told by teachers, a teacher who teaches here in Fairbanks, that sort of this Berlin Wall in education is crumbling and things are looking up. And I suspect or hope that that is true, but I keep standing off on the fringes of things, yelling and shouting in the hope that if the Berlin Wall is crumbling, that I can push it all the way over.
A reverse of the boy with his finger in the dike.
Right.
In this country, our current president ran on a platform of education. Said, I will be called the education president. In this country, we say we value education. I think I know the answer, but the question to Eric Forer is, do we?
Well,
what would it look like if we did, if
you're
the answer
is no? I think
the
president's statement was entirely spurious. I couldn't be pinned down on that. I don't know what he's really done or not done, but I haven't seen evidence. I don't see teachers shouting peons about federal policy in education. And the question of whether the nation values education sufficiently is very very interesting one. Certain groups of people certainly value it. they value it to the extent of spending $15,000 or $20,000 a year to send kids through high quality or at least big name schools. People well know that the economy is tied into an education, and then without a degree, a job is not going to be an easy thing to find. But it's almost as if something's been lost in the process. An education as a ticket, as a meal ticket, is one thing. An education as a means to knowledge and as a means to a world view and as a means toward lifelong, a pursuit of lifelong learning as part of your value system is another thing, and that I think is slipping badly. I told a story at a board meeting about a cigar rolling factory in the South 100 years ago. Great big open warehouse full of people rolling, making cigars. In the middle was a platform, and on the platform every day sat one of the cigar rollers, a different one every day, who read to the rest of the rollers. And they read everything. They read the Bible, they read Shakespeare, they read current fiction, they read newspapers. And one day they came to work and the platform was gone, because an efficiency expert realized that if that one person was rolling cigars, his production would be better. And I think that's precisely what's wrong in America today. There aren't enough readers.
Platforms in the square.
There are not enough platforms of people reading stuff to each other, because that is something good to do, to learn about things in order to get through life. That part of education is slipping, and it's being driven out by efficiency experts as a metaphor for the dollar, I guess. There's the requirements of the economy and efficiencies and competition and what have you. One of the costs of that seems to be a more educated lifestyle, educated in the broad sense of the word, not in the meal ticket sense.
When he was a young man, Eric Forher wrote and had published a book. It's called From the Nets of a Salmon Fisherman. It was published by Doubleday in 1972 and is the saga of a young boy man, neither one nor the other at that point, coming to terms with himself and his land. Eric Forer built himself a boat in Fairbanks in 1968?
You couldn't pin me down to the year, but yes.
Around in there.
And build a skiff in Fairbanks.
And floated the Tanana and the Yukon to Nome over the course of a couple of years.
Yep, 2 years, Fairbanks to Nome.
All right, let's come back to the University of Alaska and take a look at, this is an if you had your druthers question. There's no economic press, there's no mood to create efficiencies, and Eric Forer actually has his hand on the tiller. Where would you take this university? I said University of Alaska Fairbanks, I mean the University of Alaska statewide system. Where would you take it? What would your dream be, given your thoughts about education?
Well, it's pretty hard to divorce yourself from those things which you face every day, but Well, I would try to make it possible for the community college mission to be delivered, available in most of rural Alaska. I'm not suggesting that we need to have a campus in Lyme Village. But Lyme villagers need to know that the University of Alaska is out there as one of their options. And I would make the campuses sufficiently sized so that the youth of the state, a reasonably large percentage of the youth of the state, will have a place in those schools. I don't think that an unlimited budget is necessarily a good thing for any institution. The constraints of budgets makes people do better with less. And doing better is the important part there. So to some extent, the continuous budget crisis is healthy. There's a lot to be said for evolution. We sit here as a result of it, and we didn't have an unlimited budget throughout evolution. In evolutionary terms, we are products of efficiencies and the requirements of a budget battle that's been going on since the Pleistocene or sometime. So my wish for this university is not that it be granted all the money in the world, but that it learn more about itself and about what it actually is best at doing. I think nationwide universities are being dragged into political battles, which they are not in a position to do anything about, because politics is a zero-sum game, or at least political power is a zero-sum game. There's a finite amount of it, and if you get one party gets power, they have to take it away from the other party. But universities are about open discussion of all kinds of ideas. So these are two entirely sort of inimical kinds of processes, and the university needs to remember that it is a university and not a political institution. So in my vision, there would be less fighting at the university and more thinking.
When you talk about hauled into political battles, are you talking about the current problems over what is called political correctness?
Yes, that and other battles. There's all kinds of battles at the university. There's battles over contracts and battles over buildings, facilities construction fights, and on and on and on. The university is not really about those things. It has to fight those fights to some extent, but the university is about knowledge and about the future. And it keeps getting, that vision keeps getting lost in the hurly-burly of everyday troubles, and the everyday troubles tend to take over the thing, and pretty soon we've lost our vision of ourselves and our vision of what it is we're about.
How do you open the door to one without the other crowding in? If we have budget constraints, which you say are a necessary and correct part of the university reality, then we're going to have deteriorating buildings and not enough space for you and me both in the same place. We're going to have problems that you want to run your botany program and I want my English master's program, and there's not enough. All of that goes into the mix. How do you protect our university from our fights? Can you?
Well, nobody's figured out a way how to do it yet. From the point of view of the board, limiting myself here back, dragging myself back from the position of being handed the whole throttle in the whole boat,
right.
You have to hire administrators who can retain a firm grip on that vision and walk through some of the fights and come out, emerge with the vision intact. And that takes some visionary stuff from board members as well. It's easy to get dragged down to the level of the fight and just never reemerge, you know. Where is he? Oh, he's over there buried underneath a pile of parts, you know.
Here's another question about things universities should address. Governor Hickel, as we have mentioned in the first half hour of this program, has directed the university, asked the university to specialize regionally, to become the University of the North. And I wonder if it isn't a good recommendation for the university to chew some of the problems of the North. It does at the Geophysical Center, but the university doesn't work on subsistence. The university doesn't tackle the difficulties, let's say, as an academic problem of the economic future that we face. Should the university sit as a center of discussion on our current most pressing political and philosophical problems in the area in which we live? Students, professors, researchers?
Well, I'm not sure that it should. Should the university sit as a center of discussion? It can. That leads you to the question of who is the university. If I know 50 people who work at the university, every single one of them works for a different institution. Everybody's university is different, which is probably part of the beast. I think the university can provide forums and places for discussions like that to occur, but for the university to have a position on those kinds of large issues is not something the university is about.
I don't know whether it's a position, it's an answer that I'm wondering about as much as it is an offering to the fray.
Well, different contestants in various frays often come to the university for research, for numbers and for history and for what have you, and I think that that may be our strong point, is to provide a basis, like a baseline in a massive experiment. Mm-hmm. Where do you go for your baseline? Well, you go to the university, to the library, or to the institute that's been working on the particular problem, and you find out what the deal is, to the extent that we are able to know what the deal is.
So as a consultancy organization, the university is fulfilling a purpose in
yes.
current arguments.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Where do you think this university is going to be in 10 years?
Well, I'm quite optimistic, actually, for a number of different reasons. Well, it's sort of indirect evidence. There's a lot of indirect evidence that the university is held in very high regard by the people of the state. In 10 years, I suspect that we will be slightly more specialized above the undergraduate level. I am myself in favor of that. It's the only thing that makes sense. Because of the cost of major programs, and because of the size of the state and the budget, specialization is certainly in our future, and it will probably produce programs that are better in themselves. And I see a considerably enlarged student population, which is just plain demographics that they're out there coming for us. And I hope that I see a different kind of funding structure, which involves in some way the permanent fund, individual contributions, perhaps from the permanent fund. I think that we will inevitably see income taxes. There are all kinds of propositions. A Hickle appointee to the Board of Regents has not failed at one single meeting to ask these questions of other kinds of leaders in the state. He has asked city managers and Chamber of Commerce presidents, would you be willing to commit some of your resources to the university? Would you be willing to support a private, an income tax? Would you be willing to support the idea of some permanent fund involvement? It's his thing that he's asking and pushing, and that kind of thing is in our future, and I think in 10 years it'll be here.
Is there any chance this university won't survive?
Well, there's always a chance, but I think that if it doesn't survive, it will be because of events which will be so overwhelming that the entire face of the state will be changed in some major way. I think that given the survival of everybody else, the university will survive.
Mm-hmm.
If the university is not here, it will be a different world.
It's taken cuts since 1986. Is there a point where the cuts become crippling, where the system becomes fragile to the extent that it cannot become robust again? That is to say, the last scenario is that it survives, but...
Yeah, there is a point
like that, and we're close to it now. I don't keep these numbers in my head, but I think at the last major downturn, the university lost $15 million in its budget on an annual basis, and we've been losing ground to inflation and federal requirements and a myriad of other things, things called fixed costs and probably sort of what is known as overhead. We've taken a lot of hits, and one of the things about the university is that they respond in a responsible way to the community. Unlike other institutions, they sit down and think about it and scratch their head and say, yes, we realize the budget is falling and we should participate in this process. And because of the political realities, they end up being the only one that does that. And then they look around and say, whoa, wait a minute here, you know, we took this hit willingly to help out, and now we're down here at this lower level, and all it did was damage us. We damaged ourselves by participating in this process. So that is sort of behind my recent efforts to say that the board should, in fact, stand up and start fighting. We don't have any choice here now. We can't meekly wander off and become smaller and smaller in the face of our responsibilities. We must fight for the university and for the increased responsibilities that it faces.
Your bets on success, this time, in this place, with the potential threat that the university faces?
I'm quite encouraged. I'm quite optimistic about our success. In my personal experience, the governor himself and the state administration responds to legitimate, concerned public opinion. And that opinion has made itself felt. We have already had some major successes in the way the administration is viewing the university, and I expect to have more.
Eric Forer, my thanks. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. We have spent an hour with University of Alaska Regent Eric Forer. He is in his second year, going into his third of an 8-year term on the University Board of Regents. Out of Juneau. Our pleasure in having you here. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
I hope you'll join me again next week. I'm Susan McInnes. This has been Conversations.